Welcome to Talk the Talk from the Association of Union Constructors. In this podcast, we explore the latest labor trends, industry insights, and important issues in the world of construction. Join us for conversations with industry leaders, subject matter experts, and innovative visionaries as we discuss how we are building the world of tomorrow.
Talk the Talk, presented by the Association of Union Constructors.
Today we have something really special. We have this is our very first ever Talk the Talk podcast video edition, and we're here with Ike Pritchett from Hard Hat Saved My Life. Ike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the invitation.
So I just want to start, tell me a little bit about your background, how you became an iron worker, and just the story before the accident.
Okay, well, it started a long time ago, actually. I was 14 when I started putting out metal buildings for a guy down the street. I lied to him, told him I was 16. Because he wouldn't hire me other than that. So I actually started doing it when I was 14. By the time I was 17, I was running two crews for that guy. It was really awesome. So I knew right then that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go to college or anything else. I just wanted to graduate high school, and I wanted to go set iron. So right out of high school, I got in Local 10, got organized through Local 10, got in their apprenticeship program. So February of 1999, I become a member of Local 10 Iron Workers. Like I said, book number 126-3430. I love my job. It's awesome. You get to build the skyline. You get to build bridges. The infrastructure of the city is what you get to
You're assembling the world. Like, yeah, you're putting it together. So you graduated in 99?
No, I graduated in 97. Okay. I had waited a little bit.
Okay. I was like, oh, wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I graduated in 97. My dad was a Teamster, and he actually got me a job for a short time loading and unloading cars for the Teamsters, brand new Fords on and off the rail. I didn't like that job because I didn't see production. You would come in and you'd have the same amount of cars out on the lot and the same amount of rail cars there. And all you did, you just kind of switched them back and forth.
Right.
You know?
No, you didn't get to see the effects of what you were
doing. Yeah, I didn't see any production. It was cool, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't my cup of tea. I wanted to build stuff. So that's how I got in. So right when I first got in, I had the metal building background. So they placed me with building erections on the metal building side. We started off doing metal buildings way bigger than the ones that these little barns that I was putting up. I mean, they were, you know, these huge warehouses. It was pretty cool. So I got my feet wet in that. My older brother was in ironworkers also ahead of me. So he was like a really badass connector and got to go to any job that he wanted to, really. So he finally got me away from building erections. And my first like real structural job was a Hawthorne power plant.
Okay.
That was pretty intense. A lot bigger iron and that kind of thing. Then we moved. That job was wrapping up. And then I got into Lafarge Concrete, another big industrial build. A lot of big iron. It was really cool. Unfortunately, I lost my brother in 2000. He was an iron worker. He fell off of a bridge, building the Choteau Bridge, November 17th, 2000. Shortly after he passed, I went back. I was a third-year apprentice, and I was back in school through my apprenticeship, and I run into another, of course, iron worker friend of mine, and he's like, where are you working at? And I was like, oh. Apprenticeship was the only time you could drag up as an apprentice. You could go to a different job if you got a referral. And he's like, why don't you come over to Clarkson? And I was like, well, you got a Clarkson. And I knew a couple of the guys over. He's like, well, we build bridges. And I was like, oh, I don't know if my family wants me to you know, jump over there right after that. But hey, March 2002, I started with Clarkson Construction and started building bridges. And it's amazing. It's awesome. Because like I said, you get to actually build something that everybody uses every day.
Right.
They depend on it to get from A to B. And there's a lot of people that only know one direction. So if you have that road closed, you do.
Now, just for my personal, like, when you get there, are you replacing bridges? Are you building new bridges? Are you refurbing bridges for the most part?
So it's everything.
It's everything?
So it's everything, yeah. So design, build now. On these new ones, you'll demo some and build new ones. We got a couple bridges going on right now that are rehabs. You take the deck off. You do some beef up underneath and you know, just structural repairs type things.
Of course.
And then put a new bridge deck on top of it. So it could be a whole new bridge in an area that never had a bridge before to replacing in certain spots that you know, already had bridges, but you tear them down and build new to just, you know, repairs on existing bridges. So
yeah, like you said, it's things that people use in their real life kind of passively and absently, like every day. It's
right.
It's a necessity to them. That's really cool.
Yeah.
It's different than moving cars on and off.
like, yeah, 100%.
Moving cars around a lot. It's a very different world.
Yeah.
Okay. So you lost your brother in 2000. He fell making a bridge?
Yeah, so he was working on a Choteau Bridge, which was another big bridge that went over Missouri River in Kansas City. What happened was he was a go-getter. He was 110 mile an hour, bottom line. They're out on a river pier that was like right next to the river. The girders were 15 foot deep, and the bearing pad was off just a little bit. And what they had to do is they had to go down there, jack the girder up with the hydraulics, and then move the bearing pad. And we call it a porta power, but it's a hydraulic ram. Move the bearing pad, reset it, get it right where it's supposed to be, and then let the girder back down. He got a little anxious. Nobody could get him the porta power fast enough. They were looking for a piece of rope to lower it down to him. He got a little anxious, untied, climbed up, grabbed a hold of the porta power, and it's a pretty heavy assembly. Long story short, he lost his footing on the way down.
Yeah.
And he wasn't tied off. Yeah, so that's going on. Yeah, I mean, it's been 25 years.
Yeah.
But I talked to a lot of the same guys that have worked with him, you know, throughout the industry, and I do the job that he did too. And it's really cool because I wish I could have done one with him.
Sure, of course.
But carrying on, it's almost like carrying on a legacy too, because like I said, he was really awesome. Like I said, he was a badass connector and everybody knew it. You know, sure. Anybody from Kansas State knew who Mac was. He was so.
Lose your brother. I mean, that has to be really hard. Was it ever like, maybe this isn't the right job? Maybe this is too dangerous? Maybe
I thought about it, but I was young. At that time, I didn't have a family. I didn't have a wife or kids or anything.
Sure.
And I was vested. I was making good money, good insurance and everything else. And that's what my family even asked me. They're like, are you gonna get out of it? And I'm like, hell no, I'm not getting out. I was like, you see the money we're making? I'm making, I mean, the money's great. Retirement already. You know, I got a retirement plan. I got insurance. And at this time, I'm 21 years old.
Right.
You know, I'm sitting on top of the world, really. And no, I wanted to continue. And the only time that I got scared and almost got out of ironwork was 2008. We were doing a bridge, 69 Highway, flyover. So it flew over the top of another bridge and then down around. And the boss that I was working for, actually, I was working at Iatan, and then they asked me to come in and bring a crew in. I was actually supposed to go to a different job and do these expansion joints on a repair. It was supposed to be a real simple night. And it was a weekend work type thing. We'd been working up at Iatan on the powerhouse, and then this was a weekend shutdown for the highways. And Mitch calls me. He's like, hey, had some issues. There's some other guys that aren't coming in. I need you, instead of going over to Manchester, I need you to come down here to 69 set some girders. So I was like, yeah, we can do that. I had me and two other guys. So we get down there, and this is the first time I've been on the job site, but we were going to set these huge double splice girders that were already spliced together. We had to walk out. We had to pick them up, spin around, walk out on the highway to set everything.
Okay.
Big pick. The capacity of the crane was like right at like 92%. I mean, it was...
Jeez.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we start picking up the girder, and he gets it, what I call sidetrack. Wayne, the operator, he turns her and he's like over the side of the track. Well, when we crawl out, we got to kind of crawl up a hill. And I was like, don't you want that in front of you? I was like, let's swing that girder all the way around, get it in front of you. He's like, no, I want to crawl out like this. I was like, all right. Well, he starts to crawl out. When he does, the plates that we had underneath for stability for the crane,
sure,
one of them shot out. When it shot out, it made the crane drop. Long story short, we lost the load. It tore the boom out, the girder come down, and all hell broke loose. I mean, we was lucky nobody lost their life.
I was just about to say, was everyone okay? That doesn't look...
Yeah, so the only injury we had on the job was our CFO was out there at that night, and he was watching this big pick. And he's, you know, when all this shit come crashing down, he takes off running, jumps over the barrier wall, because everybody's running just whatever direction they can to get out of there. And he jumps over the barrier wall. When he does, he hits some gravel and blew his knee out.
So it was related to the accident, but not even related to the accident. Like,
yeah.
He got injured running away from
the accident.
Yeah, that's funny.
I heard the boom of the pinnet line. The pinnet line is what broke, and then that's what dropped the girder and pulled the whole jib out, or not jib, but the mast of the crane out. I heard the pop, and I was standing between the tracks talking to the operator, and I heard the pop, and Wayne told me, he's like, I never took my eye off you. Girder's falling this way, boom's falling this way. I take off running towards the back end of the crane because I'm like, hey, everything's going that way. And as I'm running, it was night, and all I see, it looks like rain coming down. And what it was, all the cable backlashed and was coming back over the back side of everything.
Okay.
And I'm running, as hard as I can, as fast as I can, as far away as I can. And everything, dust settles, everything comes back. First thing we do, hey, get a count of everybody. Hey, who's where? Yeah. You know, start calling out names. Everybody gets back over there by the crane. We're sitting there. Everybody's all right. Nobody's injured. And Wayne looked at me, goes, how did you bob and weave through that cable? He's like, I kept watching you. And he's like, you were just zigging and zagging through that cable. And I was like, nah, brother, I was running straight. I was like, good Lord must have had his hand on me.
That's awesome.
And so that was the first and only, I shouldn't say only, but that was like the first major time that I almost thought about contemplating getting out. I went home, grabbed my two kids at the time.
Sure.
And I held them for like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And I was like, my son, I remember he was big enough that he was like wiggling. He's like, Dad, let me down. I was like, nope, you're not going anywhere. Yeah. Like, I'm just going to hold you. But then after that, Mitch called me up and he's like, hey, he's like, we're going to reset that bridge. He's like, you want it? And I was like, damn right.
Yeah. If you fall off the horse, you get back on.
And I was like, it ain't going to kick my ass.
Right. No.
And
I get that.
And so it was about almost 3.5 weeks later because it deformed a little bit when it fell, of course. And they brought this company, and I've never seen anything like it. It was really awesome. It's called Flame On. It's a company. They come out and they heat straighten everything. And so we stood the girders up. We cut the splice plates out. They made new splice plates. We stood the girders up. They did this heat straightening on this thing, and in 3 weeks, we're ready to go again.
That's crazy.
And I'll never forget it. The main superintendent, Dick Warner was his name, the night that we were setting this girder back, I mean, we did. We went slow and low. Everybody was on edge and everything, and I got it set, and we're grabbing it with two helper cranes to hold on to it so we can bring another girder up because you got to set two and then set the diaphragms in between because it was on a radius or have to roll, you know, wouldn't stay up there by itself. And I just remember the main superintendent come over. He's like, if you just do what I told you, get rid of that sumbitch, let's go. We got to get another girder up there. And I looked at him and I said, hey, Dick, we already dropped this sumbitch once. We ain't going to do it again.
Yeah.
I said, so we're going to do it my pace. And he ended up walking off, but I'll never forget it. And you could see the sigh of relief when the guys got it set and everything went great and we got everything tied in and the sigh of relief, it was just like, you can feel it throughout the whole thing. And then everything really just started rocking and rolling, going smooth. So that's about the only time that I thought that they'd make it out.
You talked about something interesting there. So the superintendent was like pushing you to move faster and you kind of pushed back on safety, and that's awesome. Talk to me about like the safety culture that you got your book in 99. We're talking 26 years. You know, when you hear the really crazy stories, it's always some guy back in the 70s. But, you know, you've been just the 2000s, basically, 99. How have you seen the safety culture evolve just this century?
So it's amazing. I'm not going to lie. So when we first started off, number one, you had an MSA hard hat, 6 foot lanyard. At first, we didn't have double lanyards. You had one. So you're never actually 100% tied off.
Right.
And then they switched, you know, of course, you know, you got to be 100% tied off. So now you got two lanyards on your back. I was raised up with a lot of old school iron workers.
Right.
And we would do safety, but we would go in a roundabout way doing safety also. I'm not going to lie, I didn't always tie off. I didn't always do everything the way you're supposed to do it. I was kind of a go-getter, and I wanted to be known as the fastest, the best, and you didn't have to come back, fix my work, and get in, get it done, and that kind of guy. So we, safety culture-wise, shit, I can't tell you how many times we didn't have safety glasses on. We didn't wear gloves. I'd cut off shirts with a Miller harness that I got from my brother that was probably not good. You know, I mean, it'd been around a while. You're supposed to inspect it and everything else. And I'd move my D-ring way down because I didn't like it up between my shoulder blades. So it wasn't even positioned correctly, you know. But throughout my career and safety changed, I think a lot of stuff started changing right around the time that they brought out. So we do a lot of work on the road, roads and bridges, of course. So I think we were like pretty much the first step of the high-vis shirts and vests and that kind of thing. And I remember everybody complaining so much. Oh, these things are so hot. They're so heavy.
Sure.
I don't want to wear this and I don't want to wear that. And it was just like that. It was just like you still had to evolve with the safety. So we changed and we had to put the high-vis vests on now, and it had to be the 4-inch sleeves with the class three reflection, blah, 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 you know, and everything else. So safety evolved. It wasn't there when I very first started. And part of the reason that I wasn't as safe as I am today is because I was uneducated also. Sure. But through time, and as I moved up from just being a guy in a gang to a foreman, to a general foreman, and then to a superintendent, there's a lot of things that goes into the safety aspect of it. And at the end of the day, nobody comes in to work wanting to get hurt.
No.
I promise you. All my guys, I try to surround myself by guys that are actually better than me and faster than me because it makes my job a lot easier.
Absolutely.
You know? And so I take on what they want to say too. Like if they need a different tool or they need this or whatever they need to help them get the job done, I'm fine with that. I can get you whatever you need if that's going to make you feel better. But then in turn, I have to also be like, hey, but I need you to do this for me. And that's where the safety involved come in. The safety director, Jeff Gamble, for Clarkson Construction, when I very first started getting up into the foreman, general foreman era, I made good friends with the safety guy. First, it wasn't good terms. he was coming out to complain about how we're doing things.
Yeah.
But me and him developed a really great relationship. And then so that's why he would always come to me. He's like, all right, here's the deal. I got this new product out. I want you to try it. I want you and your guys to try it. And no matter what it was always, he would come to the ironworkers first because we're the biggest assholes when it comes to anything. And he's like, if I can get you guys to do it, and then all the other trades will follow, I promise. But if I can get the ironworkers, he's like, but the only way I'm going to get the ironworkers is I'm not an ironworker. I got to get you to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you do it, then your guys will follow you. Then everybody else, it'll trickle down. It'll follow in suit. And so, yeah, Jeff Gamble, like all my apprentices at the times, you know, he'd come out with a new harness or whatever, or a new this or a new that. And I'd be like, all right. And I'd pick out one of the guys. And I'm like, all right, come over here, change your belt out, try this belt out. And that's how we started getting our safety program a little bit better than what it was.
Actually, I'm going to stop and go back a little bit. You and I are roughly the same age. I'm a few years younger, but I came up through IATSE stage rigging. So I was doing like concerts and stuff. Mm-hmm. So still walking cables, but the things I have are a couple hundred pounds, not a couple tens of thousands of pounds. It's similar math on a different order of magnitude. And I remember exactly, I'm wearing the harnesses and like safety guy's not looking. I can get out there and get back.
Right.
Like I can walk. And we can do this faster. I can do this cooler. I don't need to put a lanyard on my wrench. If you drop a wrench, someone will die. But like I was right there with you. But at the end of the story, you're the one testing all the, what changed? What made you willing to battle test the stuff for the safety guy?
Because I got more educated on what we really actually need to do. We had a false sense of security. Like when the steel cable retractables first come out, I think they kind of sold us on a false sense of security. Mainly I just wasn't educated. I didn't know enough about them. We'd have these 50-foot retractables and they may not be tied off, but maybe 3 foot up.
Sure.
But then you're way out here with it, and then you're over a leading edge. And we thought that since it was steel, if you fell and it caught the side of whether it's precast girder, steel girder, whatever, that you're fine because it's steel. It's not steel on steel. It's not going to break. Then I went through a couple classes that our safety guy sent me to and sent a couple of us superintendents and him himself. And then we started getting educated on, because like I said, when I would talk to some suppliers, I think I just got false sense of security. I thought I was doing right for my guys. But the whole reason that I switched my thinking of the safety culture, like I said, it does go back a lot to my brother.
Sure.
It goes a lot back to my nephew that still asks me questions every day.
Sure.
You know, because he was 2 years old when his dad passed. So it still hits me all the time of when an accident happens, it's not just to that person. It's a ripple effect and it affects everybody around you. It affects your family, affects everything.
Sure.
So at the end of the day, I want my guys to go home safe. And I tell my guys this all the time. They get mad at me when I tell them buckle their chin strap, tighten their leg straps, whatever it is. And they're like, why do you always get on my ass? I'm like, because I don't just need you today.
Right.
I need you tomorrow. This job's not a day. It's not only a freaking day long, you know? Right. I was like, so thing is, you need to get your job done, but you need to do it safely. And if you're not wearing your PPE properly, it's not going to do its job. So you have to wear it properly. Once you start wearing it properly, number one, hopefully you never get hurt. You don't have to let it do its job, but you have to wear it properly to do its job.
Right.
And because here's the other deal. I don't want you to get hurt because I need you tomorrow. And then I don't want to have to call your fucking wife and say, hey, Joe fell over here and hurt himself because he wasn't paying attention. He got in a hurry. He got complacent. And I'm not about production as much as I'm about you going home safe, coming back tomorrow, because we'll always do it again tomorrow. We'll always have another day to do it.
When I got to running crews, rigging and stuff like that, and I was like, hey, don't do that. You're going to get hurt. And if you get hurt, I'm going to laugh at you. And then I'm going to feel bad.
Yeah, and so then please, I got to fill out paperwork like, and shit.
Like, just for me, like, I don't care, man. You're a dumbass. But like, yeah. For my sake, I don't want to laugh at you and do that. Don't do it. Yeah. Like, I get it.
Yeah. So,
okay, fast forward back. So you're testing the equipment for the safety guy. That's really cool. And is that how the helmets entered the new Type 2s?
Yeah, so the Type 2s, we were out on a bridge. It was a repair job, big, long bridge, across the river. And Jeff Gamble come up to me again. He's like, all right, here's the deal. And I knew it because I said on the RAB impacts RAB board, and some of our guys that were in Denver, they had already started implementing these on certain the bigger jobs, the mega jobs, you know,
sure,
that kind of thing. And of course, I did not want to change my hard hat. I got my hard hat. I got my style. I'm an iron worker. This is our style. This is a brown hard hat. I'm not changing. Jeff Gamble comes out. He's like, well, here's the deal. You know, it's coming. And I said, well, all right. I was like, give me everyone that you got. I said, because the only way I'm going to sell these guys on it, you got to give them options. Can't just tell them this is the one you're going to have.
Yeah.
I said, we got to give them options so they have the most comfortable piece of shit on their head that they think that it.
Yeah.
I was like, if you give them options, it's their idea, it'll be a lot easier to sell them on it. So we did. We brought out and I can't remember what all three, I know it was like Milwaukee Cask and there was another one and I can't remember which brand name it was. But anyway, brought them out and everybody hated the chin straps. I didn't have a problem with the chin strap because I ride a motorcycle anyway and used to it. So I didn't have a problem with it, but that's how we decided to go with which one we did because, like I said, I left it up to the guys and the guys got to make the decision, whichever one was the lightest and felt the most comfortable and didn't have some of them had some irritating chin straps, I guess, or whatever. But yeah, so Jeff Gamble come back and I was like, all right, well, all my guys, you know, we've been doing this for like 3.5-4 weeks and I'd make this guy wear it for a while and this guy, you know, and I just trade it off. The only problem we've run into is getting applications for it for the welding hoods and that kind of thing.
Right.
Right. When it first come out, they're doing a lot better now.
Right. But all the attachments and stuff.
Yeah. At first that was a brick wall that we were hitting because they didn't have the right halos. These new Type 2, they actually come down a little bit lower to help out on the forehead. And when you'd bring your welding hood down, that was interfering with
your actual vision.
With your vision up there. And so we had a couple guys kind of manufacture their own and kind of, you know, just kind of jerry-rig one up and try to make it work. But like I said, they've come a long way with attachments now. With that being said, when we did that, we also did our elevating of our stanchions. Most of our bridge stanchions were right at waist level.
Okay.
So I went to Alliance. They sent me to another safety, it's like a week-long training for fall protection, fall arrest, fall rescue. I mean, it was really, really a good training. It kind of hit every point. And Alliance is the company that makes it. And, you know, they have their own line of safety and everything. And when I went down there, that was another thing where the false sense of security that I had with these other retractables. And I'm sending videos back to my safety guy. I'm like, hey, we can't have those out in the field. We can't use them the way we were using them in the field. We weren't using them properly. Goes back to what I was saying earlier. If you don't use it properly, it can't do its job.
Sure.
So went back to Clarkson and brought back this pamphlet. And that's one thing I will say. They've never given me a dollar amount that I could spend on safety. So yeah, I spent over $500,000 changing out. And that was only changing out maybe 50% of our safety lines.
Oh, wow.
But we elevated our tie-off. So now it's 7 foot or 72 inches is 6 foot. So when it kind of comes down, sags down a little bit, it's right about top of your head.
Sure.
You know, we did away with all the 6 foot lanyards. There's no 6 foot lanyards on any of my jobs anymore. Now you got the double retractable on your back. And then what that does is if you were to fall, it eliminates your fall distance.
A lot.
Period. Yeah. Luckily, we haven't had to see that. I only seen it one time and it was a carpenter. He stepped out onto an overhang jack that had plywood on it and just stepped into a rotten spot.
Sure.
And he fell, but it caught him so fast that he was literally able to grab the line himself and step back up on the girder. He just had to balance himself a little bit. It was less than a foot and a half drop, and he stepped back up on the girder. That's how fast it caught him.
That's crazy.
Like I said, the other ones, if you had your 6 foot lander, you're tied off at your waist, you're falling almost 16 foot actually before
Yeah.
Your lanyard and everything, absorbers, everything hits.
Want to get your company message in front of the top leaders in union construction? Place an ad on Talk the Talk. Our listeners are owners, contractors, and labor leaders who shape the future of our industry. It's a direct way to reach a powerful, engaged audience and show your support for union construction. Learn more about advertising opportunities at talk.org.
I remember I went to a safety class about, you know, for stage rigging, and they talked about how, like, just because it catches you, that's the beginning of your problems. Like, you know,
right.
You're now dangling from 180-foot, 120-foot grid, and getting you back up, getting from compression, from all the different things that could go wrong at that point, it didn't save you, everything's fine. That's when the problems kind of start, and it's you learn that, but the retractable ones are, yeah, they stop you much faster. They don't,
yes.
There's less whiplash.
Yeah, and then we even went to some of the harnesses didn't have the trauma straps.
Sure.
I don't know if everybody knows what that is, but what it is if you do fall into your harness, it's just, you just undo these little, they almost look like bungee cords, and you know, you can put them under your feet, and then you pull them a little bit tight, and then that way it takes off all the pressure that the leg straps put on, because it can cut your circulation off, and then now you have more problems, just like you
that's
said.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, the compression. Yeah.
Yeah. So it all goes back to educating yourself on safety. And once you educate yourself on safety, and it makes a lot more sense, and you're going to go ahead and do it, you know? Because like I said, at the end of the day, everybody wants to go home safe. I don't want to see anybody get hurt, and I want you back tomorrow.
So you know, you've been trying these helmets out with your guys. Was it that first job when you were still trying them, or was it was the next job when?
So it's almost 2 years down the road. We'd already implemented these helmets for 2 years.
Okay.
Through Clarkson, this was a joint venture with another company, and I did have to hire a lot more guys than I usually had at Clarkson. I had a lot of work going on. I had this massive bridge project going on where I had 60 iron workers just on that job, and then Clarkson had other jobs too going on. I mean, it was a major project. It was $280 million project with 107 steel girders that were 15 foot deep. This thing was amazingly huge, over 10,000 ton of iron, you know. Jeez. So integrating those new guys into it also was a little bit tough. And like I said, they'd wear the hard hat, but then they'd want to take the buckle and they want to strap it back here. And they wouldn't.
Right.
So going into my accident, when my accident happened, one of the weirdest things I heard, but it was true, was my guys were like, I know it happened to you, but I'm kind of glad that it happened to you, because you wore your PPE properly. You always had your chin strap buckled, and you got in our asses all the time. Like, literally, like, the safety guy would be like, hey, if we go for a whole week, and just in the morning when we come and do our stretch and flex, and we go through all of our JSAs and everything, if for 1 week everybody has their proper PPE on, their glasses, their gloves, their boots, your vest on, zipped up, your hard hat on and buckled, I'll give everybody $20. And I can't tell you how long it took.
Because the whole crew to go a week.
For the whole crew, because, I mean, you're wrangling, and I'm not just talking ironworkers, but ironworkers, carpenters, laborers, you know, operators.
That's a tall order.
And I'm like, God, how do you not just put your shit on when you get out of the truck and, you know, you're ready? Why aren't you just ready for work when you come, you know? It's like herding cats. It's little kids sometimes. But so that was one of the issues that we always had, was wanting to buckle it behind your head. And I couldn't get it through their head. But I'll tell you one thing, after my accident, I don't think I'd be here today if I didn't have that chin strap.
Sure. No, yeah, absolutely.
100%. And like I said, that changed all my guys' outlooks too, because it finally happened right in front of them. And it sucks, because safety says this a lot too. Sometimes it takes a tragedy before you change. Luckily, it wasn't a tragedy. It was an accident.
Sure.
But the culture changed for everybody
that
day going forward.
I imagine. So, I mean, we've heard the story and we've watched the video, but just walk me through it again. So just tell me that story of kind of what you remember and what happened.
Okay, so we had already preset some girders on a false work and a pier on one side, and a false work and a pier on the other side. We had to do a drop-in, so there was five railroad tracks underneath, and UP railroad tracks. You had to get windows through their work windows and that kind of thing. So we got all this stuff prepped. Well, what we had to do that drop-in, so we had a double air splice, and sitting through meetings and everything with them and coordinating everything, we finally got them to allow us to have 4 hours track time. That way we could get the girder up, get it set, get it safe.
Before the next train had to come through.
Before the next train had to come through. we got all this planning going on, and we know these are big girders. Like I said, the short girder was 91,000 pounds. It was big. So the first day, everything's out there. We got Porter Power, Shane Cumlongs. We got everything started up. And hey, we're only like 2.5 hours into it, and we already got the girder in on both splices, and we're beating pins in. We're going. I mean, things are looking up because I literally just went, like I said, I come back down to my guys, and I was like, hey, here's the deal. We got a 4-hour window. I was like, we got to get it done. I was like, when I was in that meeting, I was like, UP, the first thing they say, well, what's your contingency plan if you don't get it done in 4 hours? And I was like, they're like, are you going to set the girder back down? I go, we don't set the girders back down. We put them up. We don't fucking take them down. This ain't a demo.
Yeah.
You know, this is direction. We're putting them up. And so I done run my mouth, you know, all these UP guys. So we get out there, and that's why I told them, I was like, hey, here's the deal. We have everything in place. Anybody think of anything else, I'll go get it. But this is the date that we're going to do it. All eyes are on us. Big deal. First day, like I said, everything's smooth. Goes up, 2.5 hours in. We're giving the track back in 3 hours. We're looking good. And I'm like, yeah, pumped, you know.
Yeah.
And then I know after the first one, usually everything goes a little bit faster, And so next day comes, get the second one up. Everything's good. And on the third day is when the accident happened. And what it was, I was sitting there, we're going up, and I'm standing up there, and it's like 2.5 hours in, and they still don't have one of the ends made.
Okay.
And so I look up, and I'm like, hey, what's going on? And one of the brown boys that was on the cap, they're like, hey, yesterday we had 9 come-alongs up here. Today we only got 5. He's like, we got to move that girder back still like 1.5 inches. I was like, no shit. Well, I look up, and I run over the Connex. There's 2 chain come-alongs, 2 3-ton chain come-alongs over there. So I grab them. I'm like, hey, come down, get these real quick. He comes down. He gets them. He's going up. And then I look up, and on the girder that we just set the previous day, they had left one right there. So it was still tied off to that girder. I'm like, shit. I already yelled at him a little bit. You know, why is this taking so long? We've already done this twice. So I just grab my belt out of my truck real quick. There's another lift there. I jump in the lift. I go up, and I'm going to take this chain come along off and move it down and help him get this girder pulled back because we're getting close to our time. And I already told UP, we don't set him back down. And so
what would have happened if suddenly it was 3 hours and 55 minutes? Like, was there any real contingency here?
we were going to set some bitch no matter what. I don't care if it takes 5 hours.
That's what I'm just saying. So we just have like angry train riders sitting on a bridge. Okay. Yeah. Just, I wanted to understand.
Yeah. It's just UP saying what we have to do because they're God.
Got it.
So I go up, and what I remember going up, I step out of the basket, I tie off the cap, turn around, untie from the basket. And when I came to, I was in the hospital. And I looked down.
So the last thing, just untying from the basket is the last thing you kind of remember.
Yeah, I don't remember anything else.
Okay.
And so when I tell my story, it's all what my guys—
what you guys have told you happened.
Told me. And so Brown said that he heard this loud pop. And he said, I seen you hit the back wall and just slide down. He's like, I didn't know what the hell happened. I didn't have a clue what happened. But he had a radio. Everything was done on radio for the connectors and the operators and everything. And he had a radio, and he radioed out. He's like, hey, Pritchett just went down on the cap. I don't know what the hell happened. Jake, one of my foremans, he was at the opposite end of the girder I was at. He takes off running down the girder. Both Brown brothers, they come over. And Trevor, these kids are like my own kids. So literally like their dad is an iron worker. Their grandpa was like my football coach. He was an iron worker. They're like third generation iron workers. So Trevor says, he's like, I grabbed you. And he's like, I was just sitting there holding you. And he's like, there was so much blood. I just kind of didn't know what to do. I just kept holding you. And he said, Jake got down there. He's like, get the fuck out of the way. And pushes him back. And my face has started swelling. So he had to unbuckle my chin strap. He said, unbuckle my chin strap. Well, he pulled my helmet off this way. Well, when he did, this whole flap of skin and everything just come down. And I about lost my eyeball. He said, I just took it and I rolled it back up. He said, I reached over and I grabbed, Brown had a sweatshirt that was laying up there. One of the other Brown, Trevor did. He had a sweatshirt that was laying up there. He said, I just grabbed the sweatshirt to start wrapping around your head.
Yeah.
And he said, there was just so much blood everywhere. And he's like, it wasn't like normal blood. He's like, it was like dark color. He's like, it was, I've never seen anything like it. So they're taking me out of my harness. That lift that I had was right there that I had accessed up there.
Sure.
So it was right there. So they're getting me out of my harness. This cap's huge. We had plenty of room up there to do all this without too much problem. But they got to me first. I mean, they got to me right away. And Jake said, when I come to, they were taking my harness off me, and he's like, I kept rubbing my eye, and he's like, dude, you can't touch your face.
Yeah, do not touch your face right now. I'm sorry.
Touch your face. He's like, and I was like, it's burning my eye. And he's like, there's a lot more worse than just burning your eye. He's like, we got to get you down. We got to get you to the hospital. He's like, you're hurt and you're hurt bad.
Yeah.
And I was coming in, going out, all kinds of stuff. And he said, I got up. They helped me up, and the basket was right there. They didn't have to climb down in the basket or anything. When I left the basket, it was right where you could just step into the basket. And we step in the basket. He's getting ready to take me down. I was like, where are we going? I was like, we got it pulled back. Take me out there. Let's make this fucking girder. And he's like, you see all this blood? This is yours. It's not mine. He's like, we're going down. And so they got me down the ground. The first responders that first showed up were the firefighters. The firefighters were there first. The ambulance was way at the back. We're on this little outer road, and we had it all shut down between, cranes and material and lifts and everything else. They had to park way back. They couldn't even get all the way down to us. And so I'm sitting down there, and they're doctoring me up. They're putting some stuff on my head while the ambulance is getting there. And I guess they was going to pull a stretcher out and come down and get me. And I told him, I was like, I don't need no stretcher. I can walk up there.
Sure.
They're like, oh, it's like a quarter mile. I was like, I don't give a shit. Well, I start walking. Jake and Billy, they go ahead and grab me.
Yeah.
And so apparently I walked all the way up there. Got in.
Oh, so that with their help, you insisted that, okay.
Yeah.
I missed that part of that. I assume they wrestled you back onto the stretcher.
No, they didn't even have the stretcher down there yet. And I'm like, hey, you don't got to go get that shit. I got this.
Okay.
So we walk. They helped me, and we walked all the way up there to the ambulance is what they said. And Billy calls my wife, and he's like, you got to get to the bridge. He's not with us right now. That was when he first got the phone call. I hadn't been down yet or anything. So my wife, I got to back up and tell a little backstory from what happened earlier that morning.
Sure.
So the last conversation I had with my wife, I had to go in. I had had knee surgery once, and then I tore it again. And I had to get it. Actually, I had to do it again. And I just got out of Dr. Day's office, and I call her up. And I'm like, hey, this is February 21st when the accident happened. So February 21st, I call her. I'm like, hey, I just got out of Dr. Day's office. March 8th, we're going to go in and do surgery. He's like, don't know how severe it's going to be until he gets in there. So it might be a deal where I have to keep my leg stiff for over 6 months for it to heal. I said, so you're going to have to come to the hospital. You're going to have to come to the surgery that day and take me to and from surgery. It's in and out, though. And she's like, well, I got a big event that day. And you're probably just going to have to call your mom and have her take you. I said, I don't give a shit what you got going on. You can get your girls to cover your catering event. You're going to be there. You're my wife. And I hung up the phone. And so the next phone call she gets, this accident happened. And my foreman tells her, he's not with us right now. So she thinks I died, comes flying down to the bridge. Before she gets there, he calls her. He's like, hey, they got him in the ambulance. They're taking him to Truman. And Truman is literally like 6 blocks from where the accident happened. So luckily, we had a hospital real close. So she gets there, but she actually beat us there because they're still like getting me in to the emergency room, and they don't know, they can't tell her which room I'm in yet type thing. So she's sitting out in the emergency room waiting. So the first person that comes out to talk to her is the chaplain.
Okay. Oh, so geez.
She thinks
that
I didn't make it.
Yeah.
And so she's having to come apart out there. And this is about time I come to is I'm in the room. The guy's sewing me up. I feel blood again. I look down. This guy's got ostrich skin boots on. I don't know where I'm at. I'm like, man, them are some pretty nice boots to have on in here. And he's like, I was on my way out and they asked me to come sew you up. And I was like, well, I appreciate it. I still can't figure out where I'm at, what's going on.
Sure. But you remember that part.
But I remember that part.
Okay.
And I look over and my dad and my brother are sitting there and my wife. And I hadn't seen my mom yet. I hadn't quite got over there to her. And for whatever reason, I must have went back to the conversation earlier that day, and I thought maybe I was in there for knee surgery because I looked at her and go, what the fuck are you doing here? I thought you had to work today. She's like, I hate you. I hate you. What do you mean? And so then that's when, then it's other things that I started coming to and everything. And so they got me all stitched up, got me into an ICU room. And then that's when I actually started getting to have some of my guys. They all stopped, come down there, of course, to the hospital.
So they didn't make the 4-hour pick then?
No. No, they ended up setting the girder back down.
Okay.
And I didn't know about that at this time. And so I'm sitting there, and my wife's in there with me. and my foreman's come in, and like each, I guess each come in at different times, you know, or whatever. And they each told me that they had, they're like, oh man, we fucked up. We had to set that girder back down. We ruined your record. And, I said, what do you mean you set it back down? After all this shit, we got it right?
Like, you had one job, man.
You couldn't throw some more bolts into some bitch before you come down, you know? And she said, I chewed all three of their asses. And each time when they come out to talk to the next guy, to let the next guy in, they're like, there's nothing wrong with him. He's still the same asshole he was before.
He feels like, fine.
He's fine. There's nothing wrong, you know? And yeah, so like I said, a little bit of an icebreaker there too. But the camaraderie of the brotherhood and the sisterhood of the ironworkers was amazing. They did. They shut down that job. They all come down there. They all wanted to make an appearance, see me, or at least see my family.
Sure.
And then it just followed suit even after the accident. Through my recovery, through my injury, my recovery and everything, it was the same way. I mean, they were there all the time. They checked in with my wife all the time. They, whatever my wife needed, my owners, everybody. I mean, our business manager, BAs, our safety guy, the owners of my company were down there several different times in the hospital and everything. I mean, I couldn't ask for a better group of guys that I work with. I couldn't ask for a better brotherhood of a union. And I sure the hell can't ask for a better company to work for either.
That's awesome. And I mean, it's incredible about it. If we go back to the accident, what happened? I know you don't remember it. You untied, walk me through what you didn't know but know now. What happened?
So when I went up there to remove the come along, to move it down, what happened was they had already started pulling on the other end of the bridge, and the bridge is still kind of tied together, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So as they were pulling on this end down here and they were adjusting these girders, it racked this side of the girder that I was on and it overloaded the come along. When it overloaded the come along, when it broke, the hook broke and the body of the come along is what come back.
Got it.
And got me.
Yeah.
In the face.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, again, I'm not trying to like point finger. What shouldn't have happened there? Should they have not been pulling on it? Should you have not been there? What chain of events led to that? I mean, the helmet saved your life, and we're going to get to that right. Second, but I still don't know. Like, you went up, you didn't see any problems, you unhooked, and it all happened. Where did that fall apart?
So 2 minutes either way, if I'd have been 2 minutes slower, 2 minutes faster, whatever, that chain would have never broke, or it would have already broken. Nobody would have been there. Bottom line is we should have taken it off before we moved down and started pulling on everything else.
Right.
Unfortunately, we didn't. So the chain of events just happened to wrong place, wrong time.
Wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah.
Missed opportunities to get it. And yeah, absolutely.
And like I said, that's one thing that I didn't understand when the guys were like, we had 9 come alongs yesterday. Now we only have 5. Well, what'd you do with them? Yeah. I wouldn't have taken them down. They're 3-ton 10 come alongs. You know, they're 120 pounds a piece, you know? Yeah. It's not like it's something easy to...
Yeah, you don't leave it in your pocket.
Yeah.
Forget it's there.
And that's why, because I did. I did kind of chew their ass. I'm like, what do you mean you only got 5 chain come along, man? You know what you had yesterday. Why would you go up and you don't have all your tools? Why, you know?
So, weirdish question. Do you still have the helmet?
I do. I finally got it back. So, actually, OSHA, when they did their investigation... They kept it in my harness and everything for a long time.
I would imagine, yeah.
I never did get my harness back, which it is what it is. I didn't fall into my harness because I fell against the pier itself. So I never took any kind of shock load to my body, or my harness didn't take a shock load. It was the hard hat in my head.
Right. That took all the shock.
But it took a long time. Like I said, the joint venture company, I won't say any names that we were with.
Sure.
They didn't want to release anything. Liability issues, I think, more than anything. But I finally did get them talked into. I'm like, hey, here's the deal. I want that hard hat because I want to be able to have it.
No, it's a great, it's...
And if I brought it in, you'd be like, well, where's the damage?
Really?
It took so much impact. It looks like it just kind of rolled it. I should have brought it with me. I need to take a picture of it and put it with the slides.
Yeah, but send it. Well, I can put it in the show notes of this. Yeah.
So it really just barely like rolled one corner, and there's like a little bit of damage to one corner. But the suspension inside is just trashed. I mean, it took that foam.
So the plastic, but everything else just, that's awesome. It did its job.
It did its job. And they're like, well, we cleaned it up a little bit. But when I got it back, there's still a little bit of hair and blood in there, you know. And my wife's like, are you going to clean that out?
No. Like,
no, that's character.
That's why. Don't ask us. No.
I'm not cleaning that
out. Why would you clean that out?
Yeah, it's not about pretty.
No, that's awesome.
So, yeah, I did get it back, and it sits in the garage I need to bring it inside and put it with my other hard hats because I got my very first hard hat that I ever got, you know, from my brother. And then I have a hard hat that he used to wear all the time. And then I have my regular bridge hard hat that I wore.
The brown carbon fiber.
Yeah. So I still have all three of those hard hats inside. I don't know why I've left that one in the garage, maybe.
So we are running a little bit out of time, but walk me through the injuries. You said, so it caved in your skull.
Yeah. So when the initial impact happened, it hit me in the left side of my face, head and face, which until it slammed me back against the wall. When it slammed me back against the wall, not for sure. It was a stair step type pier. So I'm not for sure if I hit like a edge of the stair step bearing device or the concrete bearing pad itself or what I hit. But what it also did is shove my L5 forward 10 millimeters. So my L5 was hanging off of my tailbone 50%. So when they went in, they initially saw all that. So they started doing all the scans up top. Of course, we had the crushed skull. They had to go back in. I tore all my sinuses. I had crushed my sinuses across here too. I broke two teeth from clinching. Apparently, when I got hit the back wall so hard that it actually cut my head, I had two stitches in the back of my head from the impact going back also.
Even with the helmet, you had two stitches. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And so like day five of being in the ICU, they kept bringing me in pillows for my head. And I'm like, my back is what hurts. It did so much nerve damage over here that I was very fortunate that I didn't feel any pain. I promise you, I didn't feel any pain. The only thing I had is this eye would kind of, it still does today. It flutters and it kind of wanders and it'll go in and out of focus a little bit. But I had no pain whatsoever. It feels like a sunburn over here.
Sure, okay.
At all times, the nerves are just gone. And so I just kept complaining. And they told my wife, they're like, hey, we're going to have to get him up and get him moving around because we're getting ready to send him home. And so they get me up and I can't hardly walk. I said, I keep telling you guys something's wrong with my back. Well, then they finally did an MRI, and then that's when they seen that disc. I also had two bulging discs that they had to clean up while they were in there, but they ended up, the surgery that we had to wait 3 months, had to wait for this to heal up. This surgery right here for everything on my face and my sinuses, that was five different surgeons, and it took 9 hours. And then turn around, and 3 months later, almost 3 months to the date, May 19th is when I went in for my back surgery. And when I went in for my back surgery, they call it a L5-S1 surgery.
Yeah.
And what they did, they put six screws in my back, four titanium rods. And what it did, it allowed the two screws up, the four screws in the L4 and the L6, actually, they put those in, put the bars in there, and then they used the screws for the L5 to pull it back in place. They stiffened those two up.
Sure.
And then they used that to pull the L5 back in place.
A little bit like building a bridge, right?
Yeah.
Like
just. Yeah. And then when I seen the x-rays, and I that's what I told the surgeon, Dr. C, I was like, hey, man, if I knew you was going to do that, I said, shit, me and my buddies could have done that. It looks like a couple, you know, self-tapping screws. And when you see it, it looks like they use zip ties and self-tapping screws. I was like, shit, we could have done that with a bottle of whiskey, you know?
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, look, there's a... But no permanent damage. No
permanent damage all the way. Like I said, this eye goes in and out. That's really the only damage I have on my face part. Nerve damage up here, of course. I still got 20/20 vision in that eye.
Yeah, I mean, so no, which is amazing. Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, my back surgery was actually like the hardest recovery that I've had throughout the whole incident. It took longer for my back to heal, and it still isn't 100%. Don't get me wrong. I do stretch and flex every morning. Just how I have to get up anymore. Part of it's getting older too, don't get me wrong. And and the line of work I'm in didn't make me a young man either.
Right.
So
you do live pretty hard.
Yeah.
Now, I guess.
Yeah. 110 mile an hour retard. Yeah. So I'm very, very fortunate. All the doctors, they never, ever thought that I would recover this fast and this well. So I'm really thankful for the surgeons that I had, the rehab that I went through. It kind of was enduring at the time. I didn't want to do some of it.
Sure.
But yeah, it really did. It helped out. And like I said, the last slide that I'd put on that was my wife. She's amazing. This is a lady that had to take me to all my surgery, all my follow-ups, all my doctor's visits. She kept everything straight. It was kind of a pain in the ass with getting everything completely right through insurance, through workman's comp. There was a lot of stuff a lot of paperwork stuff that was messed up. She stayed on top of everything and kept everything correct. It took me about 3 months to heal up on my head. I was at fall risk. I couldn't hardly get up. I couldn't do a lot of things on my own. And then right after that, now, hey, guess what? Go back in for a back surgery. I'm down for 3 months again. I was the worst patient ever. I don't know how she stayed with me, you know. But like I said, she's my rock because most people wouldn't want to have to take care of somebody else the way that she had to take care of me. So yeah, it was amazing. She's an amazing person. And like I said, she helped me go to the bathroom, shower, shave, everything. I couldn't put my socks on for the first 2 months.
And all from a helmet that you're saved from by the helmet that still looks good. That
yeah.
Yeah, it still looks in one piece.
It does.
So what's the lesson from it all? I mean, I know you're big on how the helmet saved your life, but what's the message you want people to hear? And what's the thing you want people to know?
Number one, PPE, it only works if you wear it correctly. That's my number one thing I want to get out to everybody. Number one, it's there for a reason. You have to use it. Use it. Don't try to get something that's not as safe for it or whatever. Don't take any shortcuts and then wear it properly. Because here's the deal. If it would have went tragic, it's not just about me. It's about the ripple effect and how it would affect my family and everybody else, my coworkers, all kinds of stuff. I still got coworkers that are still dealing with some of the seeing the scene that it wasn't even them, but they were there and they seen what happened to me. And it's still hard for one of the Brown brothers that was there. He's like, he's still an iron worker, but he's like, I can't work for you because I seen it.
And that's one of the most incredible things for me is like, there's a lot of, your story could be 100% true and it happened exactly like that. And the helmet saved your life, but it's not just to save, like you're back on the job.
Yeah.
You recovered. It was hard. And it was a horrible patient and congrats to your wife, but like you more than survived. You came away from it really okay. And that's amazing.
Yeah. And a little bit stronger.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
Cause, what they say doesn't kill you, makes you stronger. And I believe it because like I said, my wife never thought I'm too hard-headed for anything to hurt me that way anyway, but I think it really did. I think it made me stronger. It made me a stronger believer in God also and in safety.
I was telling you about this earlier. I got to go to Impact this last year and I'm sitting next to my boss, Daniel Hogan, CEO of Talk. And we're sitting there and they're like, okay, next up, how a helmet saved my life. And we saw your video and Dan starts like pushing on me. He's like, we got to get this guy to come talk to us. I was like, yeah, I know. And he's like, no, I was like, okay, I'll find who he is. I'm going to track him down. This is going to happen. And you know, you ended it. And I was like, okay, I'm in the program. I've got my phone open. I'm like looking down how to find you. And you walked over and you sat down next to me. I'm like, the good Lord wants this to happen. This is has been provided.
Yeah.
So I'm so grateful that you not only came and spoke at our conference, but took the time to talk to us.
Absolutely.
This has been awesome. And we hope to help tell your story because it's a really important story for people to hear.
Absolutely. I want to get out to everybody that I can because if it helps save one person or even prevents injury of any sort, that's my main goal.
Awesome. Hey, thank you so much, Ike, for joining us. And please share this with people to get out this story. And that wraps up this special edition of Talk the Talk, recorded live at our State of the Union Construction Industry Forum. Our thanks to Ike Pritchett for sharing his story and reminding us why safety is never abstract. It's personal, and it saves lives. If you found this episode meaningful, please subscribe, share with your team, and keep those conversations going across our industry. You can find more episodes of Talk the Talk, along with resources and upcoming events at talk.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.